started with this session. If you are new to my sessions, I'm Chuck Kuhnert. I'm professor of biology at Concordia College in Portland, Oregon. And today is my last day at Holden, for a while at least. I'll be leaving in the afternoon, and it's my privilege to speak to you today about my area of research, which is genetic engineering. And I want to talk a little bit today about the implications of genetic engineering for the future and some of the ethical and moral dilemmas that face us as we embark upon this brave new age. Before we can get into the ethical questions, however, I would like to do a little preliminary biology background teaching. And for those of you who are familiar with the biology of genetic engineering, forgive me, and those of you who aren't, I'll try and make it understandable. If you have questions as we go along, stop me and tell me that you'd like some more information. One of the fundamental points of biology is that life develops in all living creatures in amazingly similar ways. It always starts out as one cell. Every organism begins as just one cell. That cell contains a central body called the nucleus. And inside that nucleus, we have a material that is called DNA that is the blueprint for what that cell will develop into in the future. It contains the sets of instructions that dictate how the organism is going to unfold as it does. That DNA is common to all living creatures. Bacteria have it, humans have it, redwood trees have it, birds have it. Every living creature contains DNA, and as far as we know, it is basically similar, basically identical in all living creatures. That is, the nature of the DNA is identical. The DNA itself, we will get into in a little bit to just give you a bit of information that is necessary to understand genetic engineering. But it is a code that tells the cell how to make certain molecules. Not just any molecules, but the molecules out of which further cells are developed. So without that set of instructions, no development takes place. If you'd be so kind as to turn that slide projector on for a minute, there is a thing on the very back. And I'm going to turn these lights on. Just lift that further, yeah, all the way to the top. There you go. If you were in my session last week, I'm not sure anybody was, we showed this initial set of slides. I'm going to look at it again just to sort of refresh in your memory what goes on in development. What we have in front of us here is an egg cell. And the area right here is called the nucleus. And although you can't see it very distinctly, the material that fills the nucleus is largely DNA. That egg cell, that egg cell is a single cell that obviously becomes fertilized by a sperm cell. And sperm cells are barely visible in this picture. There's one sitting over here that is about to fertilize this egg. And those sperm cells are, in fact, just a bundle of DNA. The whole head of the sperm cell is just packed DNA from the father with a tail on it. That's essentially what a sperm cell is. Well, it also has a little bit more, because on the top of the head, it has sort of a hat that is an explosive device. When it contacts the egg, it actually, that cap that it wears, explodes and causes a bunch of chemical reactions to take place, which prevent another sperm from fertilizing the egg, and allows the sperm itself to embed itself inside the egg. Now, once a fertilization has taken place, then the information of the father and mother come together and unite into a single nucleus. That one cell then is called the zygote, and it contains all the information, the genetic information, of both the father and the mother, each contributing half of the information. Now, that information differs from the father and the mother. If you look around the room, you can see easily that we all differ from each other. And we differ from each other in two ways. We differ from each other because of genetic differences that we have. In other words, Scandinavians basically inherit blonde hair from their ancestors. And if you're Germanic, you tend to have brown hair instead or whatever. Or if you're Italian, you tend to have black hair. And those kinds of traits are genetic traits. The second way in which you differ from people around you are environmental characteristics or environmentally induced traits. You go out and get suntan so your skin gets darker, or your hair gets bleached because you're out in the sun, or you eat less than some people or eat more than other people so you get thinner or fatter. The basic differences that we encounter then in living creatures are genetic and environmental. Okay. Sometimes they're referred to as nature and nurture as differences. But at any rate, all the genetic information now of the father and mother are condensed in this one nucleus of the zygote, and it almost immediately begins to undergo the process of development. Now, this is an interesting phenomenon because the process of development involves splitting of the one cell into two. And when that split occurs, the nucleus, that one nucleus, does something remarkable. It duplicates its DNA. And it not only duplicates it, it duplicates it precisely so that the DNA that it makes, the copy it makes of itself, is identical in every respect to the DNA of the mother or cell originally. So the two daughter cells or two son cells, if we want to get non-sexist, are now going to have nuclei that have all of the information that the parent cell had in its total amount. All right? Then those two cells, of course, split into four. And those four cells each have a nucleus, each nucleus containing the DNA that is now identical to the original parent cell. And those four go to 8, and 8 go to 16, and 16 go to 32, and 32 go to 64, and we finally end up with something that looks like this, which is it's called a blastula, which is a hollow sphere of cells. The cells now are so tiny you can't see them individually. There are about 1,000 of them, and they are around the perimeter, and what we're seeing, since slides are two-dimensional instead of three-dimensional, you're just seeing sort of a slice through the middle of this thing, and it's hollow in the middle. This is all hollow. It's like a tennis ball, and all the cells are confined to the outside, and every one of those 1,000 cells contains a nucleus identical to the parent nucleus originally in the zygote. Yeah.
When the sperm meets the egg, are those two DNAs different?
Oh yeah, in the sense.
How do they become the same?
Well, they don't become the same. What they do is unite. To form the sperm and the egg in the first place, cells have to undergo a process called meiosis, which is different than this process. The way we got from one cell to these 1,000 cells is a process called mitosis. And in mitosis, the result of mitosis is that one cell makes two that have the same number and types of DNA, the amount and types of DNA, as the original parent did. Okay. Another way to put that is DNA is found in these nuclei in special bodies called chromosomes. Okay. So in a human being, for example, the fertilized egg, the zygote, has 46 chromosomes. It has 23 from the mother and 23 from the father. So it has 46 chromosomes. There are 23 different types of chromosomes. Okay, we number them from 1 to 23, and if you take them and spread them out on the microscope slide, you can actually see that they're different from each other, and number 21 from the mother is recognizably similar to number 21 from the father. Okay, they're not identical. In other words, their DNAs differ from each other a little bit, but the two chromosomes that contain this long body of DNA, more than a long body of DNA, they are very similar to each other. They're only different from each other in a few spots, not the whole length. Now, when that reproduces and forms those two cells, all 23 pairs of chromosomes get reproduced. The one from the mother and the one from the father gets reproduced, and it gets sent into the daughter cell. Okay, that's how this process takes place. But when the sex cell is formed, when the sperm and egg cell are formed, that does not occur. Instead, what you start with is a cell that has 23 pairs of chromosomes, or 46 total. Okay, and you end up with, in meiosis, you end up forming two cells, and then you go through meiosis two. Okay, it's a two-step process. This is meiosis one and meiosis two. And you form four cells, each cell having half of the number of chromosomes of the original parent cell. So you're going to have 23 chromosomes instead of 46 in each of these cells. Right? And what's more, those 23 chromosomes, now these again are the egg or sperm. That's how you form egg and sperm. Those 23 chromosomes are randomly formed. That is, we may take chromosome number 1 from the father, and chromosome number 2 from the mother, and chromosome number 3 from the mother, and chromosome number 4 from the father, and number 5 from the mother, and 6, 7, 8 from the mother. In fact, it's conceivable you could get all 23 from the mother in one of these and none from the father, or 22 from the mother and 1 from the father, or vice versa. You can get any combination. So it's what we call independent assortment. Okay. So these things, these sperm cells and egg cells, have tremendous variation in the types of chromosomes that they end up having. Therefore, sexual reproduction, where you get these sperm cells formed randomly and egg cells formed randomly, is going to form a plethora of combinations. And that's why you don't see two individuals that are identical on the face of the earth. If you do a little mathematics on this, you'll find that the number of combinations possible from any two parents ends up to be in the billions. Okay, so therefore, if you have several billion or 10 billion combinations possible from any given set of parents, the likelihood that two sets of parents in different parts of the world are going to have identical children, it just doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. All right. Now, at this point, we have to ask a very important question. If, in fact, the genetic material is, in fact, determining what you're going to be, what the cells are going to look like, and how they're going to develop, then if we have 1,000 cells, all of which contain identical information in every cell, how do we ever get noses and ears and eyes and livers and hearts? How do we get those things if all the cells are identical to begin with? And that's a very interesting question, and one that has plagued the biologists for centuries, for at least the last two centuries particularly, and within the last 50 years became a primary focus of research. We call that problem the problem of development. How does a cell all of a sudden change from something that's identical to the original parent to something that is different? In this particular case, you can take a cell from here and stick it over here, and this thing will grow into a normal adult. If we go back
that at that stage that was there before, it's a little difficult to do this, but we go back a little bit, we take one of these cells and we rip it out from the other seven cells and put it in a culture dish and give it the proper materials and so on, it will develop into an entire organism that is whole, complete, and normal. And the other seven cells will likewise develop into a normal adult organism. There will be no difference between the two. In fact, if we go back, if we go back to this stage, you'll notice that between these two cells there's this furrow, it's called the cleavage line. In some cases, that furrow completely invades the space between these two, and we then have two fertilized eggs, two zygotes, that develop into what we call identical twins. Sometimes, if the furrow doesn't completely dissolve, we get what are called Siamese twins, and they're held together by parts of their body that are going to be formed or shaped during development. Okay, that's so. In other words, each of these cells is what scientists call totipotent. They are totally, they have total potential to develop into anything. All right, now, if we go back to this stage, all right, look back up one. If we go back, well, that's right. Go back to this stage again. You'll notice that it's very similar. Now, there's a slight thickening on this side, but that has more to do with the angle at which we're viewing it than it does with the actual object itself. This is really a pretty symmetrical sphere. But at the very next stage, what we find happening is all of a sudden a total differentiation has occurred. Now we have some of the cells climbing into the inside of the ball. It's as if somebody took a thumb and pressed the tennis ball in. They're just growing toward the inside. And obviously, this is different from this. And at this stage now, if you take a cell from here and transplant it down here, you're likely to get a nose growing out of the hind end of the organism. In other words, at this stage, something has happened which has differentiated the cells, and each one has a determined fate, and it's set on this path to its destiny. Now, the reason for this is that way back in the beginning, when the egg was fertilized by the sperm, what we did not talk about was the fact that even though genetic information of the egg and sperm unite into this one homogeneous nucleus, yet the male only contributes the DNA and the female contributes all that other goop that's around the nucleus. And when the sperm enters the egg, it actually sets up a gradient. That is, here's your egg, and the sperm comes in over here, okay? What happens is we now get a polarity in the egg. Okay, so that this end of the cell might be called a plus end, and this end a minus end. And this cell is different in that way. And what that gradient amounts to are types of molecules. There are more certain types of molecules over here than over here, and less of other types. So now, when it undergoes its division, it undergoes its division this way. It always undergoes, the first division always occurs with reference to where the sperm enters the egg. And so we get, in this normal cleavage, we get, essentially in all organisms, a head and a tail. Okay? Then the next division goes this way. Now we get left and right sides. Okay? And when we do these divisions, what we are going to be doing is we're going to be separating different concentrations of these gradient molecules, whatever they are, so that these cells are really not identical to each other, but instead they contain materials that differ, although their nuclei are identical. Yes?
What happens when the cleavage goes through and we get identical out in this situation?
Well, what happens in that situation is that the material that is impacted by the sperm entry actually regenerates in the other half cell. Okay, so that the same gradient is manufactured there. If you want to think of it, it has not to do with the absolute numbers of molecules, but rather with reference to how the molecules occur with respect to each other. So while the gradient is, let's say it's real heavy here, and gets lighter as we go out further and further, if we divide it in half, it's still within each of these two cells, heavier here and lighter here, heavier here and lighter here. Okay, so that the pattern is replicated anyway. Okay, now what are these things? And how do they impact the development of those nuclei, the DNA? What they are controlling molecules that tell the DNA when to turn on and when to turn off its functioning. Now let me step back for a second and mention that we can shut that off for just a second. Maybe leave the fan on so it doesn't burn my slide. When this process takes place, whereby these different nuclei are affected by these molecules in different ways, one of the things we have to understand is that in each of these chromosomes, these 46 chromosomes, for example, if we were to look at that chromosome and if we were able to blow it up greatly, it would really look something like this. And if we could dissect it away a little bit, and this has actually been done, we would find that within each chromosome is a single strand of DNA starting at one end and bunched very tightly and running the entire length of this chromosome into the other end. Okay? Now, DNA, I'll give you a little bit of insight into DNA that will become important here in a second. DNA is a molecule that many of you know is called a double helix. It's actually a molecule made up of two strands that are similar to each other that wind around each other in a helical fashion, sort of like a slinky fashion. And they're held together, I won't get into the real complex chemistry, but they're held together by chemicals that we've given assigned letters to. Okay? These are called bases, and so this is called a base pair. Okay, and A stands for a base called adenine, and T for a base called thymine, and G for a base called guanine, and C for a base called cytosine. And A's always have to bond to T's, and C's always have to bond to G's. They're very simple rules. Imagine for yourself, if you will, that you have an alphabet that instead of having 26 letters like ours does, you only have four letters, A, C, G, and T. That's the entire alphabet, okay? The difference is, in our dictionaries, the words tend to be somewhere between 5 and 15 letters in length, okay? Bread is 5 letters, okay? Anti-disestablishmentarianism has, I don't know, 31 or something like that. That's the biggest word in the dictionary. But we generally have medium-sized words. The difference is that in the genetic code, the words are somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 base pairs in length, and sometimes go much longer than that. Sometimes the words get to be 2,500 base pairs in length. Now, the words that are constructed with these letters are what we call genes. And on any given chromosome, we will have about 1,000 genes, 1,000 words. So that means that if there are 1,000 words and each one is minimally 1,000 base pairs long, that means that in any chromosome we have about 1,000,000 base pairs. In other words, 1,000,000 runs on this ladder. from here to here if we just looked at the genes. Now, unfortunately, in humans, genes are only a minor component of the chromosomes. There is a lot of DNA between genes that we don't know what it means in most cases. It's just what we call spacer DNA. It just sort of sits there between the genes. So in fact, one of these chromosomes is really about 10 million base pairs in length.
Are those four letters the only letters that exist in,
yes.
Exist in the
genes? Yes, that's all there are. A, C's, G's, and T's. All DNA in all organisms has those four letters and none other. Okay? All right, now, so this has 10 million base pairs. That's just one chromosome, and you got 46 of them in your cells. So we're talking about a complex structure here. Right now, scientists are working on what's called the Human Genome Project, which is an attempt to find out what this sequence is in a single living human being, the entire sequence for all 46 chromosomes, okay? Now that's, to give you an idea of the scope of that project, it's estimated that that project alone will take 10 years to complete, even with the sophisticated computerization that we have. Let me just backtrack a second and tell you how we know what this code is. It might occur to you. You can't see these things. The DNA is not visible even under the most powerful microscopes. So you can't sit there and look at the DNA and say, oh yeah, that's an A and a C and a G and a T. How do we know it then? Well,
is that, excuse me, is that 10 years going to be just one?
Yeah.
Set, or is it
going to
be a sample of a whole series of people?
Yeah, the intent is to take one person initially and do their genome. And then they will double check it and run it against other people. Anyway, let me get back to this. I'm going to pass this around. Okay, now this is something that genetic engineers are very familiar with, and for most of you it's a very unfamiliar thing. It's hard to see from where you're at, but what you'll see is a whole series of little columns with little black marks on the columns as you go up. What this really is, this is a photo. It's actually a piece of photographic film. It's laid down on top of a thin thing called a gel. And it's called a gel because it's made out of material like jello. What you do is you take the DNA that you're interested in understanding in sequence, and you put it, you make it clean, you clean it up so it's just DNA and nothing else there. Okay, and then you stick it into some test tubes, four different test tubes. All right, so here's four test tubes. And into this, you add a radioactive base. Typically, radioactive T. All right. Now you get an enzyme called DNA polymerase, and DNA polymerase is an enzyme that does what we told you before that every cell has to do before it's going to divide. It has to make a copy of the DNA. It is the thing that makes the copies of the DNA, which allow you to make new cells. And that DNA polymerase comes in here, takes these two strands and unzips them, just like unzipping a zipper, okay? And then it uses one strand as a template to form a complementary strand. So what you do is you throw in a radioactive T and normal A's, C's, and G's. Now, if you just did this and you put it at the total, you just dumped some in there and did it, what you would get is the DNA polymerase would run the entire length of this thing and make a complementary copy, and you'd have one big molecule of DNA that was radioactive. Okay? And so what would happen is you would load it on the top of this gel, you'd put it in an electrical field, and it would run through the gel slowly, Okay, and you get one big fat band up at the top here. And it would look the same in all four test tubes. Okay. But what we do is we put specific breaks into each test tube. In this test tube, we put a break that will stop it anytime it hits an A. In this one, anytime it hits a C, and this one a G, and this one a T. Okay, chemical breaks. So the polymerase will get to this A and I'll say, oops, I can't go any further, and it'll stop. Okay. And that, now you make a piece of DNA that's only, in that case, only up this far. Now if you did that totally, what you'd get is a little tiny piece of DNA that would be way down at the bottom of this gel. Okay. So what you have to do, the secret to it is you have to put these breaks in such dilute amounts that the DNA polymerase misses them every once in a while. And so it'll go on and it'll maybe hit an A down here, and then it'll hit an A down here the next time. Now you have tens of copies of DNA in each test tube. So what you ultimately, hopefully, try to do is you get it to stop at every A. And now you get a radioactive piece of DNA that corresponds to every time there's a letter A in your DNA. Same thing with C, same thing with G, and same thing with T. So what we've done here, this is actually 10 different experiments like this. 10 sets of four tubes, okay? And we've taken the DNA, and then we've run it on the gel, we dry the gel, we lay the gel out, we put this photographic film over it, and you get these bars. So now all you have to do is you come along, and I know that the order I put them in was GATC. So now I can just go down and I can start down here. Well, see, there's an A, G, G, A, G, 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 A, A, G, T, T, C, T, T, G, A, T, 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 A, and so on. You just read it along, and you have the actual sequence of the DNA. And that's how that's done. This one happens to be actually from a bacterial plasmid that I got. Okay. So that's how you get the DNA. All right? Now, even if you know the DNA, even if you know what the DNA sequence is, still there's this huge amount of DNA, and the question is, will we, you know, how can you get a handle on all this thing, and how can you utilize it? Well, in the 70s, in the late 70s, scientists knew that if you took viruses of a certain kind and tried to get them to infect bacteria, that sometimes they could do it and sometimes they couldn't. One strain of virus could infect one type of bacteria, but it couldn't infect another type of bacteria. And viruses work like this. For those of you who have flu or cold or whatever right now, the reason you have a flu or a cold is because of a virus. And what a virus does is it attacks a cell, if this is a cell. The virus attacks the cell, and the virus is a very simple thing. All a virus is a coat that's made out of protein, and inside it has a piece of DNA, its own DNA. And it inserts this DNA into the host cell, okay? And your host cell has its piece of DNA. All cells have DNA. And this little piece of DNA, this little bugger, hijacks this big piece of DNA and tells it to, instead of making new whatever cells these are, to make new viral cells. Okay? So it's a pirate, if you will, that uses your cell's machinery to make itself. All right, now this puzzled scientists. Why would it be that this virus could attack some cells, but could not attack very similar cells that were only slightly different in strength? Well, to make a very long story short, scientists found out that in the cells where the virus was unsuccessful, these cells had enzymes that chopped up the viral DNA when it was entering the cell. And since they restricted the virus's ability to enter the bacteria, they were called restriction enzymes. Now that was kind of cool. All right, now we found out that there are enzymes that specifically chop up DNA. Well, for about 4 years, that just sort of sat there. Nobody thought much about it, whatever, but some people started to puzzle about it and to analyze it a little bit more. And they had developed the ability to do that, to what we call sequence the DNA, to find out what the order of the bases were. And they made a remarkable discovery right about 1978. They found that these restriction enzymes were not only cutting DNA, but they were cutting it specifically at a sequence of bases. So in other words, every time, if this bacteria was the bacteria that inhabits your intestinal tract, which is called Escherichia coli, or E. coli for short, okay? If that was the bacteria that the virus was attacking, what they found was the enzyme that E. coli made attacked a sequence that went like this. Okay, that's good. Okay, so the two strands of DNA, this is part of the long strand of DNA, were being chopped like this. In exactly that kind of manner. Now, if you notice something about that, this sequence is the exact opposite of the sequence below it. Okay? Now, what that produced then were two pieces of DNA, one of which had a C and a G here and nothing over here, and then it continued on with T and A and something else here. So in other words, there was a half a strand there and nothing here. And the other one was down here, and it had a G and a C and a T and an A and then the rest of the DNA like that. Well, they found out that if they took another enzyme, which was called ligase, they could get these two things to stick back together again and glue it back so that it was like it had never been cut in the first place. So in other words, once the bacterial, this E. coli enzyme had chopped this up, if they just threw a little ligase in, the whole thing would be healed. And you'd have the viral DNA active again, and you could infect another type of E. coli that didn't have that enzyme in it, and it was all hunky-dory. Well, that just a light clicked. All the scientists that were dealing with this clicked at the same time. And they said, well, if we can take that kind of system and use it on bacterial or viral DNA, why can't we use it on the DNA of other organisms? And if, in fact, this enzyme, by the way, the enzyme that cuts up the virus in E. coli was given a name. It was called ECOR1. Okay? E. coli restriction enzyme number one. It was the first one discovered. And why can't we use that enzyme then to chop up DNA from other organisms to generate these sticky ends and then just mix the DNA from a human and a bacteria and glue it back together? And of course, I wouldn't be standing here if we couldn't do that. So in the very early 80s, the perfected technique occurred whereby we could do what is called genetic engineering, where we could take DNA from one organism and splice it together with DNA from another organism. All right? Now, to turn the projector on, please.
Can I ask a question,
please? Yes, go ahead.
Where did the restriction enzyme come from?
The restriction enzyme was a natural defense mechanism that the E. coli had developed to protect it against viral attack. Okay, let me
get the light. Let's see.
Okay, well, this continues its development then from those cells that have now had their pattern changed. In other words, what we're saying is now each of the genes of those perhaps 1,000 genes on each chromosome may be altered in whether it's turned on or turned off in any given cell, so that one cell may have a gene turned on, which therefore causes that cell to become a nose cell. Another cell may have the nose cell turned off, but the liver cell turned on, so it becomes a liver cell. The liver cell gene turned on, so it becomes a liver cell. And finally, it goes through these kinds of changes. All of these parts are made of those cells, each starting from that zygote that had the identical genetic information, and now we end up with this, which is a starfish. Okay, well, that was what that development was all about. Okay, now, to get to practical applications of this, these are three fruit flies, all right? Drosophila melanogaster. And there is something sort of special about these. What you see here is the head, and this is the eye right here of each of the three fruit flies. These are the four limbs. This is the thorax, the sort of chest area, and the hairs on them. If you notice, there are two of these that are red and one of them that is brown-eyed. Okay? Fruit flies that buzz around your bananas have red eyes. They're called wild type because that's the type you'd find in wild, in the wild. This fruit fly is a mutant fruit fly that's called Rosy, although it doesn't look very rosy. It's called Rosy because its gene for making the red eye pigment is defective. It doesn't make enough red eye pigment, and so its eye is sort of this washed out brown color instead. This fly, which has red eyes, is the daughter of this fly. Okay, and it mated, this fly was mated with another brown-eyed fly, rosy fly, and so one would expect that their children would only have brown eyes. It got its red eyes because I put the red eye gene into it when it was developing, when it was a blastula, when it was in the stage of that tennis ball. Okay, now how did I do that? Well, genetic engineering has its detractors. But Carl, suppose some unscrupulous person got hold of your wonderful invention. He could use it to enslave the world. Carl doesn't look too impressed by that argument. You can clone yourself all you like, Chuck. You're only getting one salary. Okay, now how did I give that fly its red eyes? Well, this is an interesting little bit of genetic engineering, and I'll just go through it real briefly for you. Actually, I wasn't interested in giving the fruit fly red eyes. I was doing a project to understand the questions that we were getting at before about how genes get turned on and turned off in certain cells of the body. Okay, and the gene I was interested in, for some reasons I won't go into right now, was the yolk gene, yolk protein gene of fruit flies. Fruit flies make eggs, just like chickens do, and they make yolk, just like chickens do. And yolk is a protein, and it is made, the protein is constructed from instructions given by a gene for yolk. And what I wanted to do was to see why it was that only females make yolk and eggs, even though males have the genes for making yolk and eggs. Okay, all the genetic information is the same in the males and females, but only males make it. And there are other questions. In the inside the females, it's only made in the liver of the fly. It's not made in other tissues. It's not made up in the head. It's not made down in their legs. It's only made in the liver. Why? all of those parts of the body also have the genes for making yolk. Why are they turned off? Now, this may seem like a trivial question, but in fact, it is the fundamental question of cancer, for example, because cancer is really a set of genes that have been switched on that normally should be off. And so if we can answer the question of how we trigger these mechanisms, we go a long way to understanding things like cancer and lots of other diseases as well. Well, this map is a map of the piece of DNA that I constructed by genetic engineering. I took the yolk protein genes, which are here in yellow, and I cut them out of fruit flies with restriction enzymes. Okay. I then stuck them together with a rosy plus gene, that is a gene for red eyes, a good gene for red eye color. I just spliced those together. I put them together with another gene from fruit flies called a P element gene, which is more commonly known as a jumping gene. And these are really interesting genes because they allow pieces of DNA to jump in and out of chromosomes, sort of at will. That's a whole other story. Fascinating. Just the woman that figured that out just won the Nobel Prize about 3 years ago. And then we attached it to this piece of DNA, which allowed us to overnight make millions of copies of it inside a bacteria. So we could take this piece of DNA, the whole thing, stick it into a bacteria, much like that virus was attacking the bacteria, and get it to replicate itself millions of times overnight. So we get gobs of this stuff just like that. Don't have to, you just put it on a shaker and a soup and let it grow overnight. Next morning you come and you harvest it and it's done. It's great stuff. Okay. So then you purify this thing after it's all grown up, you got millions and millions of copies of it. And then your problem is you have to inject it into this blastula stage. Now, the problem is, in one sense, mind-boggling, because the blastula stage of fruit flies is what we call their egg. Okay. Their egg, actually, when it's laid, is that zygote, but then it immediately undergoes this very quick development. And so within a couple of hours, within 2 hours, it has developed into about 1,000 cells. Now, the neat thing in fruit flies, and why we used fruit flies in this experiment, was that all of those cells did not have none of them had a cell membrane around them. So the nucleus was accessible to the inside of the blastula. If I just got the DNA into the blastula, it could go right to the nucleus and do its work. Well, you got a couple problems. One is, of course, the eggs of fruit flies. I mean, fruit flies are small. Okay. The eggs of fruit flies are very small. I mean, we're talking about the size of the tip, not the head, the tip of a pin. All right? What you see here is a fruit fly egg, and there's another secondary problem, which is that the eggs have shells on them that are like leather, and if you're going to inject them, you have to take the eggshell off first. Okay? And we developed a technique to do that using double stick scotch tape, okay, which is what this green background is. That's double stick scotch tape. And to give you a perspective, this width is about the width of a human hair. Okay, that's what we're dealing with here in terms of size. So what you do is you rub this thing with a little tiny glass, I mean, just a hair of a glass that's pulled out from a capillary tube and got a little ball of glass at the tip of it. And you just brush this very gently, and the shell cracks amazingly. And what's more is this thing sticks to the ball on the tip of the glass. So you pull the egg away from the double stick tape and that. And then what you do is you take that egg, the blastula now, the embryo, and you stick it on another piece of double stick tape under oil so it doesn't dry out. And you inject it. And here's our needle. That's the needle for injecting. And we're poking it in the posterior end, the back end of this embryo. Okay, so I take that DNA, that circle that I made before, purify it, put it into one of these little needles, and I pump it into these guys. All right, well, I had to do 1,200 of these. And we're talking very difficult, technically speaking, to do this, because any kind of vibration really ruins it. If a person walks down the hall 10 feet away, this needle vibrates so much it rips the egg apart. So we did these about usually from midnight until 3 in the morning. And you had to do them in a cold room because if they warm up too much, the egg just gets mushy. So we're sitting there freezing at 12 to 3 in the morning, injecting 1,200 fruit fly eggs. Okay. Once you've injected them, you have to make sure that they're there, okay? That you've really got them into the thing. And that's done. These are pictures of fruit fly chromosomes. Okay, and what we've done is we've made a piece of DNA radioactive so that it will stick to DNA that's identical to it, and it won't stick anyplace else. And what we did was then we took DNA for yolk protein, made it radioactive, the yolk protein gene, made it radioactive, threw it in with these chromosomes, let them incubate for a while, and then we took a picture of it, okay, so that where the DNA was sticking, it would shoot off radioactive things and it would expose the film, and we could see that. Well, this is this long chromosome here, it goes all the way around there and down up here. And you can see that there's only two spots, one right here and one right here, where we have significant number of dots that are associated with the chromosome itself. This spot is where the yolk protein gene is present in the fruit fly normally. That's where the normal yolk protein gene is present. This spot is where mine inserted into the chromosome, jumped into the chromosome. Therefore, it becomes part of the chromosome, and that fly then passed it on to its children, and they passed it on to their children forever and ever and ever. It'll stay there. It'll just keep being passed on as it's a normal genetic trait. Okay? Now let's see if I have anything else. Okay. I don't think I do. No. You want to shut that off then, please? Okay. Well, okay. Now, similar experiments have been done since that time. These pictures were taken in 1984. And the fruit fly was the first multicellular organism, an organism with many cells, that this was successfully done in. The first time it was done was 83 in fruit flies. We did these in 84, so we were right. We were like, one of the first five labs in the world to really perfect the technique and do it. And it was the first multicellular organism to be done. Since that time, many multicellular organisms, including humans, have had genetic material inserted into them. Most recently, an example of that was about 1985, the gene for growth hormone was inserted was inserted into mice. And the mice that had the inserted gene grew rat size. So that demonstrated that you could do it in multicellular organisms. About 2 months ago, this experiment was repeated in humans suffering from a terminal form of cancer. And it was, in that particular instance, was not meant as a therapy. What they were doing was injecting cells into these people with terminal cancer, which were target-seeking cells. They were cells that were supposed to seek out parts of the cancer and attach to it. Okay? And they had to have some way of following those cells, so they attached a marker, which was a human gene, that produced a product that they could easily see. They attached that marker to these cells by injecting it into the cells and then put the cells into human beings. And in fact, the cells behaved as they were supposed to. So, and they were able to follow them with these genetic markers. Now the next phase in that kind of thing, which is called gene therapy, is we want to attach good genes two bullets that are called monoclonal antibodies that can attack only specific cells and hopefully, therefore, allow those defective genes to be modified. Let me give you just one example. And a person that suffers from diabetes has a gene that is defective for the protein insulin. In other words, their DNA sequence, the A's, C's, G's, and T's, are screwed up. Actually, typically in diabetes, they're only screwed up in one base pair out of about 1,500 that's necessary for making insulin. Just one base pair out of 1,500 is messed up. And therefore, they make a non-functional insulin. Now, insulin is a hormone that causes your body to use sugar properly. It allows, once you eat something, your pancreas produces insulin. It goes into the bloodstream and causes sugar then to be capable of being brought into the cells and used for energy to do the various functions that you do. If you don't have insulin, then the sugar in your bloodstream can't get into the cells, so you get hyperglycemic, you get sugar loads in your bloodstream that are abnormal, you get all sorts of concomitant problems with that, and ultimately it leads to many debilitating diseases and death, blindness, lots of other things. What you could do, what genetic engineers would like to do, is take a normal gene, one that does not have that mistake in the DNA sequence, attach it to an antibody that will only attack insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. So it will seek out those cells and attach them, and hopefully then insert itself inside the nucleus of those cells, produce normal insulin, and cure the diabetes. Okay. We've been working on a project, sort of intermittently, which would produce human growth hormone, therefore treating what are called pituitary dwarfs, okay, people who have a lack of human growth hormone, not because of any other factor except their growth hormone gene is abnormal. And so you do the same kind of technique there. And we're trying, what we would like to do is be able to target those cells that produce human growth hormone and thereby alleviate that kind of problem. Well, that kind of genetic therapy is going on all over the place. Now, the problem, then, is that not many of us would have an argument about curing diabetes or curing pituitary dwarfism or sickle cell anemia or some of these other genetic diseases. However, the same technology that allows us to do this also allows us to decide whether our children are male or female. It allows us to decide how tall we want our children to be, whether we want children to have certain characteristics like blonde hair and blue eyes, or black hair and dark skin, or whatever the genetic characteristics we would like to see, we now have the technology available to pre-select those concepts, to pre-select those traits, and do them for people. In addition, there are some problems that arise in the healthcare industry. I want to read a little bit, just a paragraph or so out of an article from this issue of Business Week called The Genetic Age. Okay. The ethical implications of the genetic age will be broader still. Questions are just starting to arise about who will be privy to such information. In other words, about the technologies allow us to tell beforehand whether children are going to be defective genetically as well by amniocentesis. Whether individuals will know who has access to their genetic makeup and how such data will be used. The dilemmas could be acute, given that for many diseases, a bad gene doesn't guarantee that the affliction will develop, but is merely an indicator that it might. Make too much of that, ethicists warn, and defective genes could be used to justify unwarranted discrimination. Insurance
Insurers might deny coverage, for instance, and employers might withhold jobs. Within 5 years, genetic predispositions will be used as a risk factor for employment, declares Stephen Turner, CEO of Encore Incorporated, a Gaithersburg, Maryland company that designs genetic tests. Some experts even envision a day when a genetic profile will be used to screen potential mates. Such issues are already surfacing. Recently, a couple that visited a Southwestern medical center for a genetic test learned that their unborn child had cystic fibrosis, which is a genetic defect. Their doctor at a health maintenance organization told them that unless they terminated the pregnancy, aborted the child, the HMO would cancel their health plan. Okay. Only after a social worker threatened a discrimination suit did the HMO relent. The scene may be replayed countless times as more genes are identified. We are at the beginning of something that will take 20 years to resolve, says Philip Riley, executive director of the Shriver Center in Waltham, Massachusetts. And it's too late to pull back, adds Keith W. Brown, president of Gene Screen Incorporated. The train has already left the station. So, the original question that I put up on the board, genetic engineering, panacea or panic time, I think is a set of questions that needs to be constantly asked. We will be able to cure some devastating genetic diseases by these technologies. We will also hold in our hands the ability to modify what human beings are like.